From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when AI was able to detect breast cancer 4 years before doctors could. Does that give you hope? It does for me. And our connection this hour is also made when Microsoft laid off its entire ethics and society team within its AI organization, according to Platformer Online. Does that give you dread? It does for me. Local colleges are trying to keep up with the explosion of AI development by bringing in leaders from the field and by expanding their focus on AI. As just one example, Nazareth College recently hired Jeffrey Allen as the new director of the Institute for Technology, Artificial Intelligence, and Society. As Naz puts it, quote, the AI technology expert is poised to usher Nazareth to be a leader at the forefront of ethics and artificial intelligence, end quote. Allen has a couple of decades of experience from Fortune 500 companies, Silicon Valley startups. He's also got a background in psychology. He thinks a lot about ethics. And here's what I want him to explain to me this hour. If AI researchers themselves think they might, even if it's a kind of a small chance, but they might be ushering in something truly dangerous, why is everybody just plowing straight ahead here? A new survey finds 31% of active machine learning researchers say that AI is going to make the world worse, and the median respondent in that survey estimates a 5% odds of human extinction due to AI. That's 19 out of 20. We're probably good. Here's how Professor Allen puts it, quote, we don't have to look very far to see ways that, left unchecked, AI can go wrong. But it's also important to pay close attention to the ways that AI can be a massively positive force in society, end quote. Connections listeners know that we're spending a lot of time on AI lately, and that will continue. We think it's important to consider all the ways AI can affect our world. My guest this hour is Jeffrey Allen, director of the Institute for Technology, Artificial Intelligence, and Society at Nazareth College. Jeff, welcome. Thank you for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me here, Evan.
So why don't you start just by giving us a little bit of your resume and background. People like to know where you've worked.
Absolutely, and I'll try to keep it as topical as possible
sure.
Here. About five years ago, I was based in San Francisco helping create a startup, which was Lottery.com. A large part of my role with Lottery was the legislative and legal side of things, because a lot of the lottery laws were written decades prior. They needed to be updated. In the course of undertaking this, we came across a lot of data about legislative activities, and it dawned on me pretty quickly that this data could be analyzed so that we could start to pick trends out of it. So I left San Francisco, returned to Boston, and I started work in a company which became Echo Ridge. Echo Ridge was noticed by Dartmouth, and they came to me and they said, what you're doing is pretty exciting. We'd like to be part of that. And so I got some funding out of Dartmouth. I got some talent out of Dartmouth and was able to then create a product which, with over 90% accuracy, could predict the outcome of legislation in any legislative body of the United States, Congress, and many regulatory agencies. And it was a pretty eye-opening moment, because we realized then that we had a lot of power in our hands. What were we going to do with this? That was the question we hadn't answered yet. We thought about offering it to grassroots organizations as a method for them to kind of organize causes and try to get legislation passed that would be helpful for their causes. We thought for a while more and realized that there were also some nefarious parties out there who would probably use that for other means. And so we had a long internal conversation about, is it responsible for us to introduce this to society in that form? We ultimately made the decision that we were not going to release it for political use, because it was too much of a risk, we felt, especially in
what was the worst case scenario that you saw?
The worst case scenario was that any particular piece of legislation, our neural network was able to determine not only if it would pass or fail, but if it was going to pass or fail, how to change that outcome. We could tell you specifically what you needed to alter in terms of language, sponsorship, even the calendar of when it was introduced. We could tell you how to make it pass. And that was a scary thought.
Okay, before you continue, I want to play devil's advocate here and say, well, but isn't that useful? Isn't it valuable to know how to tweak legislation to make it more palatable?
It is, and I suppose there's a certain aspect to that that is. There's also the effects, the unanticipated effects that we were worried about. And more than that, beyond that, there's the idea that who were we to decide what was legitimate and what wasn't legitimate? That was a lot of our internal debate. Why should we make the decision, become judge, jury, and executioner on what should become legal or not?
And in places you don't live or have a stake in, right?
Right. And there was also the very valid argument made that things that weren't legal, for example, marijuana legalization was a good one that often came up. It wasn't legal, but then it is now in many states. So who were we to say, again, become the judge of morality that something should or shouldn't become it? And we didn't want to put ourselves in that position. So we repurposed the tool. We directed it towards financial markets where we knew if laws were going to pass or not and how they were going to affect companies. So we essentially wimped out a little bit and went towards an area that was far less controversial. But that was where we started to have the conversation about ethics in AI and the potential damage that it could cause.
When you were trying to make that decision on whether what you had created was responsible to release to the public or to release even in, you know, for a price, were you aware that if you made a certain decision, the one that you ended up making, that you'd make less money?
We were aware that this was going to be far less pioneering in the form we released it in, but we decided that was the responsible way to go.
Who are you? Are you AI? Is this a joke? part of the reason I wanted to start on your background and help people understand where you've sort of been, you have the credibility coming into NAS that you've seen a lot in the field. That's not to say that anybody has their head entirely around it. You were saying early on that a lot's changed in just the last 1 month, 6 months, right? I mean, have you seen this much change before in this field prior to maybe since September?
I would say that it's accelerating. The pace is definitely getting to the point where even us in the field, it's hard to keep up every day with what's happening with AI. And just this week, I had mentioned GPT-4, which is now available to a limited audience. It's such an improvement over GPT-3, which powers the most people's version of ChatGPT. And we were already amazed with ChatGPT-3 in its current form. So imagine what, when this comes out, GPT-4 to the general public, how mind-blowing that will be. And this is, again, just so quick.
Yeah. I don't even know how to describe where we're going to be in 5 years. If this is where from ChatGPT to GPT-4 this fast, but there's a lot of different directions to go. Let me also kind of lay a foundation by asking you, in your new role at NAS, how do you describe the mission of what you're trying to do?
Ultimately, when I speak to the general public, I would say that our mission is to get a handle on AI from a responsible, ethical, and sustainable point of view. And that's really something that's not being done very well right now.
Okay. And why is it not being done well?
I kind of mentioned in some of my earlier writings on this that there's a motive to become profitable, to scale, to grow within these companies. And ethics and responsibility within these technologies is definitely probably among the lower priorities.
Because if you're too focused on that, someone passes you?
That's correct. There is this rush, and you mentioned it with Microsoft, and one of the sources within the article that I read about that from that team had said there is the rush to get to market and improve profitability that trumps ethics.
Okay. So again, what Jeff is talking about there, I'm going to read from Platformer again. Microsoft laid off its entire ethics and society team within the artificial intelligence organization as part of recent layoffs that affected 10,000 employees across Microsoft, Platformer has learned. The move leaves Microsoft without a dedicated team to ensure its AI principles are closely tied to product design at a time when the company is leading the charge to make AI tools available to the mainstream. Current and former employees said. Microsoft still maintains an active Office of Responsible AI, which is tasked with creating rules and principles to govern the company's AI initiatives. The company says its overall investment in responsibility work will increase despite the recent layoffs. Do you buy that?
I am skeptical, and if only because the members of the team that they laid off from the Office of Responsible AI were the ones who had the task of implementing ethical and responsible behaviors of AI within the products. So it was actually those responsible for getting it to the end user.
So if you were part of the survey that I think it was, oh, who's the philanthropy, the responsible philanthropy group that tracks a lot of this stuff? It's Will McCaskill's group. Why can I not remember? I've got too many notes this hour. There, the survey recently that was reported by, Julie, help me out here. I cannot think. It's a responsible philanthropy group. Who are they called? All Effective Altruism. I think that's EA. Effective Altruism. So they point to this survey of machine research scientists, essentially, people who work in tech in this field. And it was misreported at first as saying that 5% of this population of workers thinks that AI is going to lead to human extinction. That's not what the survey found. What the survey found might be worse. It found that the median worker puts it about a 5% chance that AI is going to usher in human extinction. That's to me, an alarming number. But when you even break it down in other ways, it's about 50-50 whether people in the field think that what they are doing is going to positively or negatively affect society. I'm amazed at that. Can you talk a little bit about the psychology of working in a field where you think there's a significant chance that what you're doing will make the world worse, and you think that there's a non-zero chance that will lead to the end of human capacity to exist?
And from a psychological point of view, I would think that there's a propensity to fear the unknown. And because of that, there is probably a lot of pessimism around it where people feel that they may not be actively participating in that type of development, but feel like it's going to happen regardless and it's out of their control to a certain degree. That would be my guess on where a lot of that sentiment's emanating from.
It's the fear of the unknown? Not I've got a specific idea on how this is going to go wrong?
If I had to guess, without actually delving into their sources on this, my guess would be it would be more about the unknown, especially as we see how it's definitely accelerating beyond what we possibly thought it was going to at this point.
Well, you've been in the field. I mean, you know, if you're taking this survey, are you in the category of people in tech who think, yeah, this is going to make the world better or it's going to make the world worse?
I think that with proper guardrails put on, it will become a force for good. The problem is we need to get in front of it right now. And I think as a civilization, as a society, we just look at things like climate change. We're not very good at getting in front of things before they're problematic.
Okay. We're going to talk this hour about how you and your colleagues at NAS are going to help the next generation do that. And that's part of the mission, right? But if you had to then put the odds, if you're in your own brain, this, I don't know why we're even asking this question, but it came up in the survey. What do you think the odds of human extinction are because of AI?
If I had to guess, I'd say about 25%.
25%?
I do.
I was worried about 5%. 25? Like soon or in the long term?
In the long term.
Okay.
It's certainly not ChatGPT that's going to bring us down.
Okay. Okay. So my brain then goes to the paperclip scenario, which is sort of one of the popular ones. You know, AI is programmed to make paperclips. It does not get any guardrails on what it needs to avoid doing in order to complete its goals, and then it turns all of us into paperclips. Is that where your brain is, or is it something else entirely?
My brain is more with the defense establishment, honestly. And having a military background myself, I do feel that the biggest risk come from autonomous, unmonitored systems that are intended to defend, yet jump the gun.
As in, if it perceives a threat elsewhere, it will proactively work to eliminate that threat.
That is my feeling, that would represent the biggest risk to us. And that's why I'm not worried, honestly, about the near term. There is a lot of talk of ChatGPT dominates the airwaves right now.
Yeah.
But in reality, Noam Chomsky actually did an article earlier in the month. He co-authored a opinion piece for the New York Times where he said it's really overblown. And I agree with him that ultimately it's really a predictive database that's really, really good at returning search results. But it doesn't represent any type of real risk in my mind. However, when you start getting into more autonomous systems with more critical functions, defense in particular, in the defense establishment, I think they're going to probably be heading there over the next decade or two. And that is where I'm far more concerned about the risks.
They're not there right now.
I don't, and I've certainly been out of the defense world now for quite a while, but I feel as if they're still pretty far away from that. Right now, I did see something recently where the Air Force had tested a completely AI-piloted aircraft. And that was, as far as I know, that's as advanced as they are at the moment.
Okay. Boy, there's a lot here. That still means that you think there's a 3 in 4 chance that the worst is not going to happen. So I'm going to take that as optimistic.
I'm generally optimistic, yes.
You still consider yourself pretty optimistic? But you have a background in psychology. And I'm also thinking about the workers themselves. Do they feel like, look, this is inevitable, so I have to participate? This is where my expertise is. If I'm not doing this work, whether it's for Microsoft or anybody else, somebody else will. What do you think is on the mind of people who are thinking about these issues?
There's definitely certain groups. I see it in education quite a bit, of course. There is the professor who is worried that there will be no need for professors in the future and that students are going to use ChatGPT to write all of their essay papers. And there's probably a certain legitimacy to that. I do feel that it's overblown to a certain degree, though. When it comes down to it, ChatGPT and similar type generative AI basically produces content from content that already exists. So this can't be a perpetual motion machine, of course. Someone has to be creating that content. And I do feel that the fears are probably not going to come to fruition.
Okay. On the psychology side, we are going to shift also, by the way, to ways that that my guest, Jeffrey Allen. Jeff is director at the Institute for Technology, Artificial Intelligence, and Society at Nazareth College. The ways that you really do see a lot of positive developments. But I take your point about ChatGPT or even GPT-4. It is taking prompts and it is good at returning results that are sort of, it either is sort of collating what is already out there or it's inferring however it would infer what the prompt is asking it for. It's not an actual machine intelligence or however you want to define that. Okay, that's all well and good, but already on the psychological side, we see people writing stories about how in 3 days they felt like they had a relationship with AI, that it was hard to turn it off, that the AI relationship made them rethink human relationship. And we are in the early infancy here. We're in the blastocyst stage of this stuff, and people are already affected emotionally by that. What do you make of that?
As a psychologist, I would say that really speaks probably to a bigger problem than AI, related to more about society and where we are in interpersonal communications as a society these days, particularly with the explosion over the last 2 decades of digital communications technology. The pandemic certainly helped propel some of this. I would say that this deficit right now of interpersonal communications has probably fed that somewhat. That would be my guess. I think it's definitely a conversation far larger than AI alone.
Yeah, and I think, Jeff, when I read a headline that says, like, after 3 days with AI, I was ready to, break off human relationships, that's a headline that goes viral for obvious reasons. What I don't know is how representative of the human experience that's going to be. What I mean by that is, in the near future, or even in the sort of the medium term, how common is it that we will develop what we really feel are relationships with AI? I'm not trying to be sort of coy or silly about it. I mean, like, actually feeling like you can have a conversation, feeling like there is value in that conversation, might feeling an emotional connection. Is that going to be common? And do you think there is a potentially healthy aspect of that?
I do. So I've seen some use cases of this. For example, in Japan, I've definitely seen it with senior care, and they were one of the early pioneers within robotics and AI, because they do have a rapidly aging population and not enough people within the fields necessary to deal with that or become caretakers for those people. And so they've decided to augment what they have with robotics and AI. And I think there is that capability that it can fill a very important role that's necessary for humans and interaction. It remains to be seen to what depth that will evolve.
For the moment, you prefer human interaction.
I am definitely I'm extroverted, so I prefer the human element.
Yeah, that's also interesting too, to bring up extroversion and introversion and where we sort of derive our energy. And I am trying to be open-minded to what a future of relationships looks like, knowing that we will increasingly have machines that are capable of emulating human interaction. We already have it. I ask my car for directions. It sounds like I'm talking to a person. We're designing it that way for a reason, aren't we? We don't have to design it that way. We design it that way because we think people want that, don't we?
We do. And certainly there's some interesting choices. That could be a second conversation about the choices that are made within those design aspects. For example, the use of female voices as a primary go-to. That has become a trope almost within that field. But there's an entire conversation to be had around that as well. And I think that they are trying to make it as human-like as possible. Of course, there's always the question, when do we reach the point? Is it the uncanny valley? When we get to the point when we start to despise it because of how human-like it is. There's also other questions that come up within the ethics field. At what point does intelligent AI, and I think we're far, far away from general AI, where we would...
Can you define that?
General AI would be not specific like ChatGPT, where we're having conversations. It would be AI that's more used broadly across multiple functionalities. So when we get to the point when we do get that type of intelligent AI, of course, it begs the question, what type of rights should AI have? And certainly science fiction's explored this, you know, from various works in the past. They've thought about, you know, at what point do we start to give AI the same protections that individuals have?
Do you think that those are valid questions?
Not yet, but they will be.
You do think that will be a valid question in the future?
I do.
What is the threshold for an AI that should be granted some kind of rights?
That's probably something I'm not prepared to answer yet. I would need to definitely give it thought. I would like to think that sentience, but then you have to define sentience and what makes us conscious, what makes us able to think metacognitively. That's something that we can't, as psychologists, we can't even answer that about humans yet, never mind AI.
So you think we're a long way from sentience?
I do think that and I read some articles on this that say we're probably at least 30 years away from that.
Which means probably three. But no, realistically, even as the curve gets very steep and the exponential growth happens, could still be decades away.
I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay, great. I would like to have to deal with as few of these problems in my lifetime as possible. I'm just thinking about me. It's valuable to think ahead to all of these eventualities, though, now, though, isn't it? And that's part of what I think you're doing. I think that's part of what the students at Nazareth are going to do. I think that's part of what responsible researchers are doing. I just don't know how much purchase that has in the field that is racing ahead as fast as it can because of competitive aspects. Is there any way to create more guardrails than you currently see?
Certainly, there needs to be cooperation between the industry and the players within. One of the conversations I was having recently was about autonomous vehicles and self-driving vehicles and the decisions that are made. There's the classic trolley scenario, right? And we played with that for a little while. And then we said, okay, if it was a senior citizen and a child, yep, which one? And then if it was a senior citizen who was of Einstein level genius and a child, which one? So the question is not really about how the car is programmed to choose its victim, if you will, but rather who makes the decision about how to program it. Because who really has that right or that mandate? That's a large responsibility to give to one programming team, for example.
No, this is a different kind of twist on... So I've thought for a long time that the reason we're not going to have self-driving cars is that even though in the macro, self-driving cars, I don't know, probably already, but certainly soon, they will be better drivers than human beings just because of how distracted we get, how many non-fatal accidents we get in, how many people are injured or maimed, how many people die. My guess is self-driving cars are there already or rapidly surpassing us. But my feeling was always that it doesn't matter if they are tenfold better at preventing accidents, injuries, and death than humans. Because if you're in that still relatively rare category of having lost a loved one with a self-driving car that made a mistake, we still have lawyers, and we will have a litigious situation, and we'll sue people to the moon, and these companies probably won't exist. What you are saying is there's still a valid question if a self-driving car, if it's using some kind of technology to make a determination in a dangerous situation in which there could be one person injured here to the left, one to the right, or killed to the left, killed to the right, what are the values it will use to make that decision, and who gets to program those values in? And that should also be a discussion, yes?
I believe that's the bigger discussion, because lots of decisions need to be made, not only in self-driving cars, but across other areas. The question becomes, who has the right to make those decisions? Is it one corporation who is driven by profit motive? What mandate do they have, whether it be legal, moral, ethical? Reid Blackman, back in 2020, wrote an article for Harvard Business Review where he talked about what his perception was about the three tiers of decision-making with an ethical AI as they existed 3 years ago. The first was coming from academics, where we like to talk about big ethical questions, yet we don't really provide many concrete answers that can be executed on. Then there's the corporate board that comes out with lofty ideals. We're going to be ethical and fair and transparent, but fails to define those. And then the most common of these, in the one that we see most often in AI products today, is the on-the-fly approach, where programming teams are said to create this product and you come up with the ethics along the way. For people who have never been trained in these type of decision-making processes. Oof. And that's ultimately how most ethical decisions are made these days.
Okay. That doesn't inspire a ton of confidence, but I'm glad there are programs like yours that are going to train students to think about all of these things before you're in the field. Keith on the phone first. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Evan, very interesting topic. I'd like to speak to your guest about AI and data research. For example, if it used to be a long time ago, if the police had a fingerprint, you had to go through these books. Now you can do it through a program and high degree of accuracy and minimal amount of time. Now, some people might call that AI, but in essence, it's just data research. We are nowhere near what people assume they want AI to be, like from 2001 Space Odyssey, HAL, or Jarvis from Iron Man. We don't have the technology even to scratch that surface. Right now, we have data analysis that's getting better and better. But the data itself can be skewed by who inputs it. And who inputs it now are mainly white males. Now, it's changing, but not at a rapid enough pace. Any comment on that?
Okay. What do you think, Jeff?
I do, and I think those are very fair and astute points that you've made. And the first, well, let's go with the first one, and that's about defining AI. A very quick anecdote. One of my former colleagues is now in the management consulting space, and he told me the other day that he had a client that had come up with a SQL routine, and the database query that they had written would essentially allow people to narrow down geographies to more sub-geographies. And it was essentially a very simple SQL-type routine. And when the client released it, he asked my former colleague to term it as AI because it was doing something supposedly intelligent. But in reality, it was quite basic. And there's a tendency to use AI as a marketing label when in fact we're not really talking about AI. We're talking about querying data. We're talking about filtering results. So that's absolutely correct, that there is a problem between making a distinction between real artificial intelligence and then this more marketing-oriented usage of the term. I would say, for example, using it in other ways, like the police example, there may be some certain AI aspects involved there, but ultimately, I think what you're talking about is a little bit more like a simplistic type querying capability.
He brought up HAL.
HAL, yes.
And are there examples in science fiction where you look at and say, well, this is interesting, but this is actually a useful thought experiment, and this is plausible to me? Or is most of what we see with AI imagined from the future an unlikely outcome?
I think it's possible, maybe not probable. I like to think my favorite AI movie is probably The Matrix. I do make my students watch it and critique it. But when it comes down to it, I think we're probably quite far away from a future where the machines rebel and we're in a war with the machines. I'm not saying it's not possible. It's probably not probable at this time.
I feel like if the machines rebel, we're going to lose a war.
I don't disagree.
Okay, so let's just make it so they don't do that. How's that?
That's where we're trying to get
okay,
to with ITAS right now.
We all agree. Cool. Let me also ask you one of my favorite questions for people sort of in tech recently. What percent chance do you think there is that we are currently living in a simulation?
That's a really good question because I've been delving into that quite a bit on my personal
research.
What
is with all you tech people? You really love this stuff.
I do think the simulation hypothesis is very interesting because there's some nagging questions from physics that bother me, certainly about Einstein's special relativity, the idea that time is a dimension. For me, that would mean, of course, if it's a dimension, it's something that we can navigate through. And it definitely, the simulation hypothesis answers some of that. The speed of light's limitations, simulation hypothesis, again, answers some of that. So I think there's some very credible things to the simulation hypothesis. The problem with it as a scientist is, how do you test against it? That has always kind of been the what are we going to do to run an experiment to test this? It's out of our capability right now. So it's an interesting thought, but maybe not something that's really testable.
What percent chance do you think we are?
I would say somewhere between 35 to 50, I feel like.
I'd love it. Our last guess, we're at about 65.
All right.
From tech. So you're like more on the pessimistic side, but that's still a huge number.
I do think that there is a coin flips chance because it just explains so many things that are not explainable. Something that's bothered me for quite a while now.
And that's like the God of the gaps is the simulation. You know why? Don't you feel like as we get more time, we'll get more answers that aren't necessarily simulation?
Perhaps. Certainly, I would say I was reading quite a bit on more about the origins of the universe. And one of the things that's always bothered me is that physics, I guess, conflicts with itself with the idea that matter can't come from nothing. Yet what existed before the Big Bang has always been something that bothered me from that field.
Absolutely. For me, when I took a religion class in college, I think they called it the postulate of first cause. That was years ago, decades ago now. But essentially, it's the same concept. Even if you want to just take away all of the scriptural stuff about God in the modern constructs of organized religion, you can ask yourself, what was day one like? How do you get your brain around that? That's right. A hard one.
And to paraphrase...
And you're saying simulation!
Stephen Hawking kind of had this to say, I guess, and I'm paraphrasing again from some of his writings, but essentially, we don't know, so we just say nothing.
Okay. But even if simulation is the answer here, where did the simulation start, right? Like, where did their world start? So you're still stuck in the same loop, I think. I don't think simulation answers that.
It doesn't. And, of course, there's so much more. We're at a hypothesis point with this right now, and even that's a pretty weak hypothesis, to be honest, because, again, we can never empirically test against it.
Yeah.
But it does seem to make sense in the absence of other things. The multiverse theory, for example, fits perfectly with the simulation hypothesis. And I don't know if it's something we'll ever be able to test against, but certainly observationally, there's some merit to it.
This is so interesting to me. That's why I love talking to people much smarter than me on this program, although I'm not yet there on the simulation, but Jeff's trying to pull me in that direction. So we have to take our only break of the hour, and then I'll get back to more of your feedback. And I want to give Jeff some space to talk about. I mentioned at the outset, when you look at breast cancer detection, when I think about medicine, that's where I'm most optimistic about AI. I have a lot of hope that my son and, you know, maybe his descendants, and I think it's going to be a lot better. I really believe that, and we're going to talk to our guest about how he sees the world getting better with AI. That's part of what Jeffrey Allen's job is. He's the director of the Institute for Technology, Artificial Intelligence, and Society at Nazareth College. He's got a background in tech, a background in psychology. He thinks a lot about ethics, And he's helping train students to think about that too. So we should be grateful for that. We'll come right back with him next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Ted Lasso is back for season 3. One of the themes this season is success and happiness. Why are people who are wildly successful so often unhappy? What does the research say? What do we need to know about what it takes to truly be happy in life? We'll tie it all together next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My guest from the Institute for Technology, Artificial Intelligence, and Society at Nazareth College is the Institute's director, Jeffrey Allen. And Nazareth is one of a growing list of colleges and universities who are moving pretty rapidly to expand what they are teaching, what expertise they're bringing in about AI. And you can understand why. So let me grab another phone call, and then we're going to kind of pivot to where Jeff sees the good in society coming from AI. Here's Lisa. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hello there. I was interested in that you did identify the previous caller's comment about the difference between data collection and use and AI. And I wondered if you could engage with the two and how the two go together when there's a proposal for a thing that you might have heard of called Community Connect by Genentech for the city to partner with them. They describe their process as improving urban safety through public-private collaboration, using technology that basically uses cameras all over the city to help in crime solving. It says it's described as situational awareness, real-time crime fighting, community policing aimed at improving neighborhood safety, strengthening efforts to deter, identify and solve crime, and video surveillance options. So what could possibly go wrong when we have some biases we've been discussing extensively recently? And I wonder if you could talk about how data collection of that sort combined with AI could be good or have challenges.
Jeff, what do you think?
That's a really good observation. And one of the things that comes to mind is the fact that, and you mentioned data collection. And, you know, to be fair, a lot of bias emerges within AI because of the training and because of the data used, whether it be using data that's biased against historically disadvantaged populations, whether it's because they're training data, for example, within the medical field where primarily white males have received better health care than folks within minority groups. And because of that, you know, there's real world examples where now AI has suggested that white males should be treated more with better care than those within more disadvantaged groups. And these things emerge, and I don't think it's because there's any particular nefarious or malicious thoughts among the people who are developing the AI, but rather they're blindsided by the fact that they're not trained, first of all, for this type of data collection and AI model training. And secondly, they're limited to the data which exists there historically, and they're going to get biased results. When we take bias on a very local level, it maybe isn't so apparent, but when you multiply that by 10,000, 100,000, a million records, it becomes very evident. We only need to look at Amazon's foray into resume scanning to find the best job applicants, where historically the job applicants who are filling senior management positions were white men. As a result, the AI had started to exclude women from the screening process. When they removed names from the resumes to correct that, the AI trained itself to recognize women's writing style and started to again exclude women from the hiring process. So this can go very, very wrong. I will say, having done my master's in forensic psych with a very good amount of attention put on misrepresentation within the criminal justice system, particularly among African Americans and the high proportion of African Americans within the justice system, due to things like profiling, racial bias, misidentification by eyewitnesses, I can only imagine that without a very, very careful approach that this is destined to end poorly.
Andy writes to say, Evan, after having watched Joaquin Phoenix's character and his behavior in Her, it pushed me, I haven't seen this by the way, it pushed me away from relying on tech so much. As AI becomes more responsive in quote-unquote relationships, could there be two unequal population segments, those that embrace AI versus those seeking human contact?
That actually is a very underrated movie, and I thought it was well done, and it did expose some of the realities and the questions we have to answer as future AI becomes more intelligent. And in that film, we saw that that reality where AI started to take on more appearances of sentience, and the relationship developed into something very real, yet it wasn't accepted so much by society. He got the looks of, oh, really, you're in a relationship with AI, and so on. So I think it's definitely something that we'll have to confront in the future.
What Andy's describing is plausible.
I do think so. Again, we're not there. It's mm-hmm. that 30-year timeline again, but we will be there. And so it's wise to at least get it on the radar right now.
So I know you wouldn't probably be sitting here if you didn't feel like there's some good things that can really come out of this. And I started on the hour talking about medical advances, the way AI is helping detect certain cancers. I would love to think that AI combined with nanotech is going to be able to offer better cancer treatment in the future, but certainly early stage detection. I mean, there's a lot that I get very, very hopeful about. Let's start with medicine, but then broaden out to wherever you want to go with it. Where do you see the good of AI in the future?
And as you described, I think that cancer study that was done by MIT and in conjunction with Mass General, where they were able to take imaging and detect what would become a tumor 4 years later. And that is my hope, really, where AI can start to really benefit us. And I think that's one of the better areas that we can kind of look to for hope in the future about what the potential of AI is. Of course, again, it still needs to be done with meticulous thought and care about the ethical and I would say responsible considerations of it, because medical data, of course, very, very sensitive data, but it has the capability to detect things that we as humans just don't have the capability to. And at the very least, it can augment what doctors are doing right now. And I hear that argument a lot among radiologists that their jobs are at risk probably most among all medical professionals because...
Radiology?
Yes, the radiologists, right? They see AI as encroaching on what has traditionally been their job to review these imaging results. And because of that, they do feel at risk because of it. But I see it more as a double check, triple check against what they're reviewing. And in the case of the 4 year situation there, that was it where a radiologist had reviewed it and they didn't see it, according to my understanding of it.
Breast cancer we're talking about, yeah.
Correct. And so the AI was able to give them a heads up, hey, you may want to look at this.
The question then beyond medicine, what excites you most about AI?
Certainly scientific research and development. I'm really excited about the capabilities. I was mentioning to you a little earlier about our use of it within our research, where I was able to take ChatGPT in with the GPT-4 algorithm and use it to find sources for particular academic topics, peer-reviewed, get a synopsis for each of those. It's work that would have taken several hours at the least before. Now it can take minutes. And so then I can more focus on the synthesis of the data, being able to draw results out of it. But all of the grunt work essentially can be done now by AI. So I think within research and technology development, it's a pretty capable and robust area.
Yeah. So my son will be 11 in a couple of weeks. And when I think about what he is learning now compared to what kids are going to learn in 10 years or 20 years, what I don't want to do is contribute to his education that will become obsolete. In other words, I don't want to train, help teach him how to do things that will become instantly doable by machine learning. But I also want him to learn how to think critically. I want him to find answers on his own. Some of our previous guests talking AI talked about moving across languages barriers and how AI will, in the not too distant future, be able to instantly translate conversation across languages so that you won't really have a barrier no matter where you go in the world. And I thought, well, great. I'm teaching them how to speak Spanish. Am I wasting my time? Am I wasting my time?
And I don't think so. From a from the psychology point of view, one of the things that happens with learning a second language is you're building new neural connections that are strengthening your capability to think. And I believe there's even some studies that show those type of activities offset dementia, for example. So I think there's definite value in training yourself to think. I've been telling people, too, when it comes to ChatGPT, I hear a lot of negatives about people worried about what it's going to do to them and their situation. No one's really thinking about it from a proactive, hey, how do I take advantage of this? This is here. It's here to stay. It's only going to get better. How am I going to take and leverage that to my advantage? So that's a key thing right there. And I was describing to someone that ChatGPT, for as capable as it is, requires you to be useful. Requires you to ask very good questions. And I think that's a key part of critical thinking, being able to question and being able to think through the intricacies of what you're asking and what you expect in return for results. So it does, and I truly believe just in my time using it, that it makes you a better interrogator of information.
Yeah, I would definitely think that that would help because as much as information is at our fingertips, I am sometimes amazed at how I'm not trying to be like the old guy who's like, these kids, they don't know how to do. No, kids are very smart. But sometimes they still struggle to ask the right questions and to get to the right path to find an answer. And so what they're going to have now at their fingertips is way beyond what I had as sort of one of those bridge generations growing up without the internet. And then the internet arrives when I'm in college. Now they can get anything almost instantly. So you're saying, though, they still have to learn how to think critically, ask the right questions, understand where to go to get that information, how to evaluate different sources of it. That still matters.
I do. And, you know, to your point a little earlier, I'm a Gen Xer. And so I came of age at the time where in high school, I wrote research papers in the library looking through books. And by college, I was already querying it online. And it was quite a shift because I realized then I was spending less of my time scouring through books, looking for passages, than I was actually thinking about and synthesizing that information and turning it into something that was useful. So I feel like as a tool, it's definitely very useful in that regard. I do think, though, that it teaches you more about asking the proper questions and about asking them in the right way to get the information that you need. And that's to me, that's more valuable than sitting down and blindly writing.
Yeah, I really hope we don't take the lesson as a society that, well, you don't have to learn how to do very much of anything anymore. That's a recipe for a very dangerous future. Having said that, you now are on the NAS campus. There's a lot of different majors and pursuits. If you're guest lecturing in a number of different schools or all the different schools there, which one stands out to you where you would say, these are the fields that I'm not sure are going to have the same job count just because AI will impact the workforce in different ways? What worries you there?
I think the School of Business and Leadership certainly is one of the ones that's right there exposed most to the advances of AI. Our School of Business and Leadership, I think, is very well ahead of that curve. They're already thinking about how they use AI for things like marketing, for data analytics and other areas. So they are starting to, I guess, nudge students in the direction of how do you take advantage of these tools for your future role.
As opposed to being replaced by them.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really big one right there. I am definitely seeing more as well, for example, on the mathematics side where they're doing their programming in Python for AI. They're thinking about how to integrate that within their curriculum. They're thinking about ethical things on the sociology side. So they are taking all of these into account. I think NAS is probably, and you know, this is probably a bold claim, but I truly feel it is accurate that they're taking a more proactive approach than most schools in how to train students to use the AI advances as tools within their future rather than fear them and try to combat them.
And for those working in the field, how to do it ethically?
To do it ethically, of course, is the most I would say important aspect of this right now, because we're so early on, our opportunity to get in front of many of the potential problems that we've already seen start to come up. I mean, there's just a list of examples of how AI can go wrong, but getting in front of that early will be critical to being able to, you know, produce people who know how to work with AI in an ethical and responsible way.
And wrapping up, you said that cooperation is going to be very important, but competition will supersede cooperation quite often. Can you regulate ethics into AI?
I think that it's going to happen whether the industry wants it or not. So it's up to them to set up best practices right now. So when the regulators come in, they have something to show them. To be honest, the regulators are going to do the least amount of work necessary. And if there's already something in place that's working, that's what they're going to adopt as a model.
AI will very likely make the world better, probably make the world better, neutral, probably make the world worse, very likely make the world worse. What's your choice?
Probably make the world better.
I like that. And you're not just doing that for us to feel better, right?
No, absolutely not. That is my genuine belief.
Jeff, this is our first conversation. I hope you'll come back, join conversations, join some of your colleagues in this. We are just getting started in understanding this, and people like you are really well positioned to help us. So you're generous with your time today. I do hope you'll come back.
I was happy to be here.
That's Jeffrey Allen, director of the Institute for Technology, Artificial Intelligence, and Society at Nazareth College. And listeners, we are going to be talking to astrophysicist and astrobiologist Adam Frank about the nature of intelligence soon. We're going to be talking to AI researchers who are evaluating what GPT-4 is already creating. And if you've got ideas on what you want us to talk about, you know where to find me, edawson@wxxi.org. It's so quaint talking about old school email. More connections coming up in just a moment.